just beginning to explore this domain of personal insight, and you know, the way that it is at times approached both in a skillful and at times in an unskillful way in the context of our practice here in the West. The skillful, developing the emotional vocabulary, the clear comprehension, the unskillful in the furthering of preoccupation and obsession, essentially with me. Now, any of you who've practiced in an Asian practice environment, although it's a little bit of a generalization, it's mostly true, you will know how radically differently that environment approaches the idea of self. I mean, for sure, in all of the years I practiced in Asian contexts with Tibetan, Thai, Indian, Sri Lankan teachers, I never once had an interview in which I recounted my personal story. I just think of how that is. And because I knew that if I was to endeavor to do that, it would simply be greeted with a kind of bewilderment. Like, why was I telling them this? And a friend of mine who I practiced with in India for some years, he told me about going in to see Ling Rinpoche, one of the Dalai Lama's teachers, after a Western couple had just left. And he found Ling Rinpoche scratching his head. And my friend said to him, you know, what's the problem, Rinpoche? And he said, they wanted to talk to me about their sex life. It was just this kind of total confusion about what had actually just happened. And well, you would encounter actually this really complete disinterest in narrative. Because as I mentioned this morning, as in the Satipatthana Sutta, really the idea of self-view is quite decentralized from the very first step that a person takes on the path. Instead, there would be an encouragement to explore anicca, dukkha, and anatta within the self story, within all stories and all formations. Now, I think in Asia, the understanding of what a healthy self looks like is a little bit different from some of the views that we can hold. Because a healthy self, you know, it's not dismissed, the idea of a healthy sense of being. But a healthy self is one that would be defined as a quality of being that is rooted in ethics and inwardly developed integrity, where we, as much as anyone or anything in this world, is worthy of metta, compassion, and generosity. And a healthy self would be one that is actually not driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. That all of this, that all of that kind of inner development is what leads to a quality of self-respect, inner respect, inner confidence and stability, all of which is part of a path of awakening. And personally, you know, for myself, I found a certain kind of relief in this decentralization of self. Because quite frankly, I mean, do you ever get bored with yourself? There was a certain relief in not taking everything so personally. And the path became actually very clear. You know, this was a path of cultivating sila, samadhi, one-pointedness, meditative development, and wisdom, being all that is needed to be attended to that would bring dukkha to an end, what would lead to awakening. Emotional healing, this is a phrase we use quite a lot in our culture, And although you wouldn't encounter that phrase, I think, in Asian, more traditional contexts, healing is approached very, very differently. I mean, there are some therapeutic approaches, certainly not all, where there's an emphasis upon kind of going through past trauma and pain as a way to healing, almost recovering the past. In a more classical mode of practice, I would say that the past is healed through the healing of the present. Our present moment relationship to the difficult emotions of sadness, anxiety, loneliness, depression. Our present moment relationship to all of this that arises, this is where the past comes to an end in terms of exerting its power over the present. If I would give you an example of this, suppose you have a memory arise of past rejection, of loss or trauma. And it arises in the present in the form of a thought or a memory with emotional associations. It's not emotionally neutral. Has emotional associations of the distress, fear, etc. that was experienced in that moment. Now, if that memory or thought is in the present is met with a different emotional response of kindness, compassion, forgiveness, non-identification, then the power that is carried from the past through to the present is essentially changed and altered by the present moment relationship. And this is actually how emotional healing would actually be defined. It doesn't mean that those patterns, those memories, those traumas don't re-arise, but there's no kind of looking for it. And when it does arise, not being fed with the same emotional reaction or pain originally associated with it. Now, what I would suggest is before that we're tempted to kind of idealize or romanticize the more traditional or Asian model, it's important to acknowledge that this too has its shadow side. There can be a certain dismissiveness of the self story and the power that the self story has and all of the dukkha that it can hold. And certainly in my experience in practicing in Asia, I've seen people have psychotic episodes, basically born of the tension of trying to suppress what they feel is unacceptable to air or bring into the light of awareness, and the suppression of that in pursuit of a more worthy goal of enlightenment, essentially trying to bypass the self. And when, you know, I think it becomes perhaps clear in ourselves that when we're self-denying, we are often also life-denying, that nothing is worthy other than liberation. You know, and this is something you often see in the kind of spiritual warriors transplanted into Asian practice contexts. A pushing away of relatedness and actually creating a very similar quality of contractedness that's found in the preoccupations with the self story. We can have just as much preoccupation with the non-self story. And in that, there can be a quality of disconnection, dissociation from the body, the heart, and then where is the basis for compassion? Where is the basis for responsibility? And the very worst case scenario, which I actually have encountered many times, is that someone acting irresponsibly or harshly and then saying, well, it's not me anyway. It's not me. There's nobody home. You know, it wasn't me anyway. I mean, in the Tibetan language, there's actually only two words for emotion, happy or sad. So all of the kind of wholesome emotions come under the umbrella of being happy, and all of the afflictive emotions, greed, hatred, delusion, come under the umbrella. It's sad. It's sad. Now, there's a certain relief in that because there's certainly far less narrative and probably far less judgment, but there can also be, you know, quite a lack of emotional nuancing and sophistication, which is actually not so helpful for clear comprehension. Now, if we take away from this, and we actually say what the Buddha emphasized was always the middle path. We know this. Not centralizing self, nor decentralizing self in a dissociative way. And I think the real question, probably, for all of our practice is, how do we merge those realities, those felt realities, that we live within a personal story without taking it personally? Not feeding or solidifying the view of self, nor dismissing the self. It's why the Buddha, in my understanding, didn't talk about no self, but actually talked about non-self, because this actually describes the middle path between the reification of the self-view and the annihilation of the self. In fact, when the Buddha talked about the dangers of nihilism, this pursuit of eradicating, annihilating, suppressing the self, he said, if you were going to choose between two wrong views, either the view of an eternal, enduring self or no self, it would be less dangerous for your well-being to choose the view of an enduring self. Because the view of no self provides no ground for ethics or for compassion or for responsiveness or for relatedness. So what we're actually talking about here, because I think too much is often made of the self, what we're actually concerned with understanding in this practice and this teaching is the view of self. This is something quite different, the view of myself. On a level of actuality, each one of us, fortunately, I would say, has a navigational self. And this will be there pre-liberation and post-liberation. It was there pre-Bodhi tree and it was there post-Bodhi tree for the Buddha. We have an address. Fortunately, we know which shoes are ours. We know where to go to work in the morning, and we can identify our own children. This is good news. Now, what we actually see is the navigational self can be affected by clinging or not affected by clinging. The navigational self can be affected by identification or not affected by identification. We start to know the difference between those two. When the navigational self is affected by clinging, then we have anxiety, we have defensiveness, we have the need to prove ourselves, which, as the Buddha put it, will arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, and despair. Now, much of the inquiry that we're actually engaging with in this path is learning to discern the difference between this navigational self and the views that are formed through clinging, the views that are formed through grasping moment to moment. What we do see is the navigational self is actually not a problem, is it? It, in fact, is quite helpful. The navigational self is flexible, responsive, connected to understanding, can learn. And it's also the navigational self through which we communicate, through which we articulate what we most deeply value: care, compassion, creativity, love, integrity. A view of self affected by clinging, we will notice, is none of these. That a view of self affected by clinging is inflexible, it's rigid, it's not only attached to a view, it's attached to the assertion and the protection of that view, it's aversive, and this, of course, in turn, is communicated and embodied. So this middle path that the Buddha spoke about, neither annihilation nor a reification, this is not a hierarchical path. It's not as if we first have to develop insight into our... Oh, that's not me. It's not... It's not as if we have to develop first our insight into our personal story and then graduate to explore the insights into the universal story of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And I think that it's so important to be clear about that, because I think so many people in practice, you know, feel that they come into practice with so much emotional complexity, so much emotional baggage, that first they need to clear the playing field. You know, and then they're going to be sort of balanced and calm and spacious enough to begin to look at the universal story of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And I don't think this is a helpful view. I actually think this is a view of self that says, I am not worthy enough, or not deep enough, or not insightful enough to go into this world because I have so much to work out. I think these dimensions of experience, both the personal and the universal, are mutually contemplated. They're not separate, but they're interwoven. They're not divided. One is not more worthy than the other. But they're woven together in the aspiration to bring dukkha to an end. I think we just live with this, by the way. So before I go on, have a pause moment. Does anybody have any questions, reflections? Yes. No self, as it's often spoken about, is talking about somehow this imagining of coming to a place where there's nobody home, you know, where there's no... no self is... Okay, it's a good question. Non-self is really describing the understanding in which we form no view of self. This is non-self, where we have no view of an enduring, independent self-existence. So non-self is really an understanding about the way that the idea of self is being shaped. Now, no self is actually this imagining that the direction of the path should be to eradicate or to annihilate any idea of self, including the navigational self. And, cheer.
So no self would actually be the possibility of just imagining things, and not self would be experience.
It would not only be an impossibility, it would also be dysfunctional. And, you know, if you do, you know, some of you who are maybe familiar with the sort of culture of the time of the Buddha, you know, when, you know, much of the culture, the spiritual practices of that time, were actually a lot of them devoted to trying to achieve this no self, actually through overcoming, through suppression, through mortification, through ritual mortifications. It was a way to get out. It was one of the great geniuses of the Buddha in his time was actually to propose the idea that the navigational self was not a problem, that actually the problem was clinging and identification, and that clinging and identification are some of the asavas, or the leaks of not knowing how things actually are.
Do you know the
I get up in the morning and I can read a diary and know what I need to do today, you know, and actually respond to that and take care of it. You know, I can know how to go to the supermarket, you know, and actually, you know, buy food and prepare a meal and have a sense of direction and have a sense of responsibility, have a sense of ethics that is rooted in, a sense of care that is rooted in, but having that kind of flexibility, the ability to be surprised, to be fluid in the world, you know? What does this moment need? Rather than my view of who I am, which also simultaneously creates a view of who you are and creates a view of how the world is, and trying to operate through that inflexible kind of system that is actually rooted in craving and aversion and delusion. So the navigation of self is just that capacity to walk this path and walk our life in an ethical, caring, responsible way that also has a sense of direction. You know, I mean, how would we even get to a cushion without it?
Is there a factor of trust in non-self that separates it quite a bit from no self?
I mean, this is maybe what I'm going to go into, because this is what I actually want to continue with. But, you know, we make this all too complex, basically. We make it all too complex. I mean, the Buddha did not reserve the teaching of anatta or shunyata for graduate students. This was kindergarten teaching. And it was not, you know, like I see it even sometimes in Western teaching, you know, we reserve the anatta talk for the last night of a retreat. In the Buddha's world, that would have been the first talk. You know, because I think we have a tendency to overcomplicate this and make it into something far more elaborate and far more unattainable than it actually is. And you know, according to the Buddha's view, you know, just look in your own experience, you know, examine it in the light of this experience, see how things actually are, that this is not complex. And I think the reason why we find it complex is because we don't take into account the reality of the navigational self that needs to have no view. And I think the reason why we're making it complex is because we're looking for no self rather than understanding non-self, which is basically understanding non-clinging. And the reason we have struggled with it, because, you know, we do have a felt experience of a navigational self, don't we? I mean, we get up in the morning, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like we slip into it like a pair of old shoes, you know, and we get on with our day. But that doesn't need to be, when that's surrounded by delusion and confusion, it's a problem. When it's not surrounded by delusion and confusion, it's actually not a problem. Well, there's certain kind of layers of kind of psychological theory where we imagine these different layers of self, and actually that's also true in Buddhist psychology, you know, that there are different layers of self-view. So it's not entirely foreign to Buddhist psychology. But of course, the work of the path is in the light of Buddhist psychology is that, first of all, it's present moment based, rather than an archaeological dig, because this is actually all that can be accessed is present moment experience, even which includes the way in which the past arises in the present. And of course, the whole of Buddhist psychology is concerned with bringing into consciousness into the light of mindfulness, the light of awareness, that which has been unconscious. You know, and there's certain agreements and probably certain areas of disagreements. I mean, the area of agreement was that it would be that the places that we suffer the most are the place where we're most held in the grip of unconscious patterns and behaviors and views. The disagreement probably would be that we somehow need to work through that rather than actually see that, have sufficiently developed awareness and mindfulness and investigation at hand to begin to recognize the moments of unconsciousness and to illuminate them. So there would be parallels and places of disagreement. I mean, the in terms of Buddhist psychology, I think the emphasis upon clear comprehension is incredibly important, and it's sometimes where in some settings that element of clear comprehension about how we came to be where we are now is dismissed. And, you know, I think in terms of Buddhist psychology that is important. We need to understand the conditions from which we arise, you know, both historically and present moment, because those are not so separate. But there also comes a point where we ask how much clear comprehension is actually required. And I don't think it's an unfamiliar experience for many people to see the mind going around some very familiar thought loops about why this is happening, you know, and why did this happen to me, and why am I like this? And actually we know the answers. We know the history of conditions. And there's actually no more insight to be squeezed out. The well is dry. And this becomes another self-obsession, almost, you know. And I think there's a certain, certainly a level of skillfulness, I think, in knowing where we have the clear comprehension that is needed to begin to explore the actual responding in a very different way, and particularly of non-identification. Tim.
I have trouble understanding how a teacher of a lot of depth, a practice, could use non-self, the sense of emptiness, to justify being a well practice.
I would have a lot of trouble understanding that too. So I'm not, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, the Buddha was so, you know, if there was one thing that he was completely uncompromising about, is that a path that is not rooted in ethics is not a path that is liberating. It was the one place of no compromise. And, you know, I don't think this is an ideological statement. I think we know this in our experience, you know, that kind of compromising around integrity leads to all is first of all is born of greed, hatred, and delusion, and will leave many residues in the mind. So it's inexplicable. It's inexplicable. Yes. Yeah, good, good, good. Okay, so that's where I'd like to go. I'd like to begin with an exploration of our understanding of atta, self. The view of an enduring, independent, reified, self-existent me, and anatta, the view of non-self. Now, atta, as I've mentioned, and if you can just kind of familiarize that word, because it almost takes a little bit less of some of the charge around self or I or me. Atta. Atta is, the understanding of Atta is concerned with really seeing how our view of self is being shaped and how it is being formed and the way that we live our lives from that formation. And that is actually what is so important, because the view of self is not emotionally or behaviorally neutral. The view of self that is shaped will also be the shape of our lives. If you know that formula, you know, what we contact, we feel, what we feel, we perceive, what we perceive, we think about. What we think about, we proliferate about, dwell upon. What we proliferate about or obsess about and dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind, the shape of ourself, and the shape of our world. This is a kind of basic psychological formula that can be tracked moment to moment in our experience. So it's not as if this idea or this view of self somehow sits over here, you know, quite inoffensively, you know, and we get on with our lives independently. Our view of self is shaping our view of the world. It has behavioral ramifications. It has ramifications in terms of the view that we form of others and how the world is. So the Buddha had a few words to say about the view of self. He said, the view of self is a vexation. The view of self is a contraction. The view of self is an inflammation. The view of self is an agitation. The view of self is an irritation. So we go on from there. He went on to say that all formations, okay, all formations, everything that is formed, shaped, compounded, all formations from the bell to me are anicca, impermanent. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to freedom. That all formations are conditioned. All formations are dukkha. They are unsatisfactory. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to liberation. And all conditioned things are anatta, empty of an enduring self. And seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to liberation. Notice it doesn't say one becomes disenchanted with the world and doesn't become disenchanted with life. One becomes disenchanted with suffering. How do you understand that?
I was thinking of clinging, thinking that these desires, these things I'm clinging to could bring me that suffering. So I become disenchanted with the clinging.
You hear that? You become disenchanted with the clinging, believing that the clinging is going to have the outcome of delivering happiness or safety or predictability. One becomes disenchanted with the patterns, the addictive patterns, that create and recreate suffering. So that the Buddha did not describe anguish or sorrow or struggle or suffering as some sort of static state or experience, but something that is dynamic, something that is being created and recreated through the ways that our world is being patterned by greed, hatred, and delusion, moment to moment, and one becomes disenchanted with that patterning. Not that it's bad, not that it's wrong, but recognizing that it's an obsession, that it's habitual, that it is born of confusion, and that it doesn't deliver the outcomes that we would wish for. And I think this is such an important phrase because this is such a shift. If you can have a sense of what a shift it is in the heart, the mind, to be disenchanted with suffering, to be disenchanted with greed, hatred, delusion, and the ways that they manifest and are embodied, to become truly disenchanted with that is quite actually a kind of revolution in the heart. Actually, quite a revolution in the mind. So, atta, or the view of self, is a story generator. It's a narrative generator. It's a repetitive narrative generator, you might also have observed. It's a repetitive narrative generator. I'm like this. You know, I need this. I'm not like this. I don't have enough. You know, I have too much, you know. I don't want this. It's a repetitive narrative generator. The Buddha put it, you know, this: the view of self is embodied in those kind of sort of like subplot views. Let's say this is mine, body, feelings, perceptions, world. This is mine. This is I am. This is who I am. This is myself. That the notion of this is mine, this is I am, this is who I am, is induced by craving, is induced by conceit, and that this is myself is induced by confusion or wrong view. That these three, craving, conceit, and views, are referred to as the three obsessions behind all of our mental proliferation. Got that? The notion this is mine is induced by craving. This I am induced by conceit. And this is myself induced by confusion or wrong view. That these three, craving, conceit, and view, are referred to as the three obsessions behind all of our mental proliferation. These are the subplots. Confusion, craving, and conceit of self, which I'm going to go into in much more depth. These are the root of all of our obsessions. So I'd like to look at the two ways in which the view of self becomes centralized. Now, the first of these is through what is called in Pali Sakaya Ditti, personality view. And the second way in which the view of self becomes centralized is through what in Pali is called Mana, or the conceit of self. This is what I referred to earlier as the different layers of selfing in Buddhist psychology. So there's Sakaya Ditti, the view of self formed around personality view, and there is Mana, which is a little bit more elusive, the conceit of self. So if we were all to sit down over lunch and have a little bit of homework and write a short autobiography beginning each sentence with I am, and you would get a sense of what personality view is. Okay? I am sad, I'm happy, I'm the body, I'm my thoughts, I'm my fears, my anxieties, my hopes, my dreams, my disappointments, my perceptions, my mind, my heart. So personality view is shaped by the ways in which there is identification with the body, with feelings, with perceptions, with emotions, psychological patterns, and consciousness. This is a moment-to-moment process. It's a moment-to-moment process. I'm ill, young, attractive, depressed. I'm this kind of person. And then we talk about types. Please relieve yourself of typing. I am an aversive type. I am a greed type. I'm an active type. You know, I'm a withdrawn type. I am my thoughts. Now, some of these personality views are very, very changeable, aren't they? You know, the kind of, you know, the anxious, complaining me in the morning can be the hopeful self-view at lunch. The agitated me on the telephone with the cold caller looks quite differently than the contented me sitting in the fog. Yet what we also experience, and this is a great a kind of like curse, I think, of identification, is that the clinging to any view of self has an amnesic element. This is the curse of identification. Is it suffering multiple amnesia episodes throughout a single day? So that when I'm caught in the grip of being, you know, the personality view of I'm so depressed, I have completely forgotten about the personality view of me being happy or contented. And also not only forgotten about that in the past, but obliterated the possibility of that in the future. So it's a total package deal, identification. It creates the view of the moment, creates the view of the world of the moment, creates the view of others of the moment. The agitated me can't remember the contented me. Views are convincing. This is what identification does. It delivers a convincing, authoritative view. This is who I am. This is who I will always be. And we are enchanted by our views. We see the views are narrative generators. We don't just have a view and leave it there. You know, if I'm agitated person, you know, I've got all my story about that, where it comes from, what's going to happen to me, how nobody will love me, you know, how I'm going to be alone my entire life. We become enchanted with our own obsessions. There was a research study done about, I mean, there's lots of research studies done in the West around trying to find the self, which, you know, really have really come to considerable agreement actually with the Buddha. But part of that, one of the research studies, they gave a mirror to an ape, a group of apes. They gave a mirror to an ape, and they'd look at it, and within seconds lose interest and kind of look behind it, you know, what else was going on in the world. You give a mirror to a human being, and looking good, you know, looking bad, looking better than yesterday, looking worse, you know, out of it. You're enchanted. You're quite enchanted with our view of who we are. The Buddha described or directly associated this view forming, the view of Atta, the story of me, as being pretty much the primary cause of distress in our life. It's the primary cause of deviating from ethics. It's the primary cause of alienation, disconnection, of conflict, of turmoil, of division, of creating the other. That the view of Atta, the view of self-forming, really is a profession, probably, of our deeply embedded craving for continued existence, the eternal me, the one who will never disappear, the one who will never die. And that, according to the Buddha, all of the other compulsions of craving, whether it's for things, for experience, for possession, for ways of being, that all of the other compulsions of craving arise from this central craving for a present, reliable, solidified, and future me. So if you could almost have the image of a kind of a wheel with many spokes and the kind of hub of that wheel, that the hub of that wheel is the centralization of the view of me, the craving for continued eternal me. And all of the other compulsions of craving are like the spokes that go out from that hub, really existing to serve that most centralized craving for my continued solidified existence. Think of the way in which that craving for continuity and, you know, the safety and the protection, the reliability of this centralized me, how that's implicated in all the ways that we endeavor to control our world, in all of the ways that we endeavor to rearrange the conditions of our world, that we don't feel at all discomforted, and that we feel enhanced, having maximum pleasure and minimum discomfort. Pleasure supports me. Discomfort threatens who I am. And it's actually, I think, fairly impossible to discern the difference between clinging and selfing. And this is something I touched on in my talk last night. I think it is so important to completely relinquish the idea that I cling. Completely relinquish that idea. Because that idea that I cling and I let go is simply an extension of the view of a centralized self. It's very helpful to let go of that notion. The idea that I cling is another self story. The idea that I let go, or should let go, is another self-enchantment. Clinging and selfing are interwoven processes. One is shaping the other. Clinging is shaping selfing. Selfing reinforces the tendency to cling even more tightly. These are not separate events. They're not separate phenomena. And it becomes apparent in our experience that a world, including my world, you know, my world of experience, that is founded upon clinging is a very, very fragile world. It gets upset. It gets upset by change. Gets upset by impermanence. Gets upset by unpredictability and uncertainty. Gets upset by other people changing. It is almost as if impermanence is here to sabotage views, including the view of self. Now, that happens to us all the time, doesn't it? I think I've got my world in order according to how I want it to be. Something comes along and just turns it all over. Change comes along and turns it all over. Now, do we learn from that experience, or do we learn to cling more heroically? Do we actually feel that we haven't tried hard enough to control everything? Or do we actually learn from that experience, which I would say probably happens to us multiple times every single day?